Colin Barnes, Reel 3.
Colin, you were talking about heading off to Bougainville and not having any training and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Tell us about the trip. Tell us about actually leaving Australia.
Well, we're in a camp somewhere in Queensland, Yerongapilly, something like that. It was an awful joint. To show how they treated you like cattle, they actually had horse troughs or cattle troughs for you to wash in, taps down the middle, and the mornings were very cold. I've forgotten the dates, that's what's got me. I think it was November 44. You had to break the ice off the top of the water that was in the trough before you could get at it. But I'd been to a boarding school where it was a cold shower every morning. There wasn't any hot showers at all. You only had a hot bath twice a week. So that was handled all right. They took all your heavy gear off you. They took your kit bag. Now, your kit bag, you had a kit bag, a haversack, and a knapsack. I forget which was which. One went on your back, one hung off the side of you, on the opposite side of your bayonet. And your brown kit bag was a tubular thing like most people would associate with the Navy. It had your name and your number on it. And then you put all your heavy gear in it, like your winter uniform and your great coat, your overcoat and things like that. And they said you can get it if you come back, you know. Give it for you. And so that was all. And they gave you jungle greens. So this time, you know, the quality of the clothing was better. It was cotton. You had a few pockets on your trousers. I think you got two shirts and two pairs of trousers, something like that, and a couple of pairs of socks. A pair of boots. But I had something wrong with my feet. I still got the same feet, believe it or not, but I got that. But they're very broad for their length, and army boots wouldn't fit me. They say they had to give me a 10 to get in. I had about 2 inches hanging over the front, and I was tripping over things. And believe it or not, they got American ones for me. The Americans were smart. We put the shiny part of the leather outside so you could polish it and look good. The Yanks didn't. They put the shiny side inside so it was nice on your feet. And then the rough bit was outside. Like, in virtually they were like suede boots, but the shiny part was inside. And they never came into a point. They were like something if you put your foot on the ground and drew a line around, they were a long sweep around the toes. They were very comfortable. Anyway, they gave me a couple of pairs of those. So I was that sort of thing.
How was your waterproof gear by this stage?
Same stuff. Since you were Bougainville with a 1914 ground sheet, that's all you had. Could you imagine? Oh, and they gave you a giggle hat it was called, or a little cotton thing. I think they still wear giggle hats, and they were wearing them in Vietnam, you know.
Why were they called giggle hats?
Oh, it'd make anybody giggle if you put it on. Have a look at it. What do you look like, you know? Just a cotton, sloppy thing that went on your head. These expressions just came out with with an Australian. It was called a giggle hat, or just a... it wasn't the broad brimmed felt hat. That was all right under some conditions, but of course it was easy to knock off and things like that. But the giggle hat was just soft and kept your hair down, I suppose, is about all it did, because it was all soft. And you got a couple of giggle hats, and then one night they took us down to the wharf and put us on a troop ship. They cleaned the hold out and they'd put jarrah bunks. God. About 40 feet of them, up and down everywhere. And I met Jack Howe again, my friend, from the queue, and the same boat. And he said, "Well, I'm not going to sleep down there, Barnsey." And I said, "Well, I'm with you." So out of all those people on the boat, I don't know, a couple of thousand, I think. A boat designed for 200 people, and we had 2,000 on, I think. He and I slept on the deck. Wake up in the morning with a sailor hosing it down. For some reason, they still hose the deck down to get the salt off it. We reckoned if a torpedo hit it, we weren't going to be last out of the hold and drown. That wasn't it. It was going to be on the top. I remember looking over the stern one night, and a huge fluorescent wake, just like daylight, behind the boat. And I thought, God, any aeroplane could see that from miles away and just know that where it stopped, there was a ship at the top of it. No one did. So eventually we were on it for a few days. I forget how many days it was now. It didn't go very fast. It was quite a few days before we got to our destination.
What conditions like on board?
Bloody awful. Absolutely dreadful. Absolutely worse than being on a cattle truck. The toilet was along the rail of the boat. Once again, a trough. The lumps of wood on, I think it had, I'm not sure it had holes or not. You did your business into it, and then the water sloshed along it, and it down and out went out one end and over the side. But if you're in rough water, it came out everywhere, all over the deck and everything. Oh, bloody awful. Absolutely, they couldn't care less. Couldn't care less. As long as they got you there, if they started off with 2,000 in Brisbane, as long as they got 1,500 of you in one piece to Bougainville, that'd be happy enough, I suppose. What's that? What's low? You know, oh, bloody awful. The meals were terrible. Overcrowded the hell, of course, troop ships always are. We get to Princess Augusta Bay. We're going to land. The Americans have already been ashore, and they were holding a perimeter of about just around the airstrip, about 6 miles. That's all they wanted was the airstrip. Didn't want the Japs to have it, so they kept the Japs back from there. And it seemed to be like everyone was happy to leave it like that, except the Australians. The Australian hierarchy wanted to go and flex their muscles, you know. I somehow think they thought that they would be like turkey shoot. They had all these poor, weak, run-down Japs that just go and round them all up or something or other, you know. They got a bloody awful shock.
Well, they were supposed to be withering on the vine.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Mm. Yes, they're supposed to be dying of disease and starvation, and they're eating grass, and you know, and all the time they had farms of their own down the south of the island, and they're being visited by submarines at night and armed, and our intelligence used to get intelligence reports around, used to say that, you know, they started off with so many thousand, and by now there were 1,000 a week were dying and all the rest, and when the war was over there were about twice as many as they thought they were, big fat. And look at them, I've got the photographs there of them, you know, all well fed and capable. They'd built a road all the way up the island around behind us. In 3 months' time, they would have chewed us up for meat. Mincemeat, I reckon. We were lucky it stopped when it did. I wouldn't be talking to you now, I don't reckon. We pull up in Princess Augusta Bay in the boat, and you go down the side of the ship over a scramble net, or some cases what they call a gangway, a sort of portable set of steps that went down the side of the boat. I was halfway down the side of the boat and three aircraft came in at mast height, screamed in. I thought, Christ, oh no, you know. By that time, I'd thought that they were over us and gone. They were Americans who were, I don't know whether Americans or Kiwis, and they're sort of saying, welcome to Bougainville, you know, scare the hell out of you, because you had to get over the side of the boat into a landing craft. And they rounded up on the beach and let you out. You let the front down, you ran out that way. I was assigned to the 12th Advanced Workshop, I think it was called. By now I'd qualified as an instrument mechanic. My dexterity had come to the fore. And our job was to repair the gun sights. The gun sights are very intricate things, mortar sights. I mean, they can't, none of that equipment will work without the sights. I mean, you can't use a mortar, which looks just a tube, without, you've got it at the appropriate angle with the appropriate charge will send the mortar bomb so far. And the mortar sight had a spirit level bubble in it, around an arc of degrees, and you could wind it along, and when the bubble was level and it was on there, that's how far the bomb, that's how they work. So our job was to, and you can imagine how the treatment they got, you know. And the gun sights off the 25 pounders and range finders, infantry range finders. We had there, yeah, that was probably the best bit of gear I ever saw, was our infantry, little infantry range finder. That was good. I think a 25 pounder gun was a nice bit of gear, but it was pretty heavy to cart around up there, the 25 pounder. But by now, the infantry had got better issue with more, the Owen gun had been more freely distributed around by now.
What were the stories then being told about the time you were in Bougainville of the conditions of the Japanese, and how long it would be before they would be defeated and that sort of thing?
I don't think anyone ever... the war came before we all died, I think, when it was called off. I think we weren't expecting that. Mm. We were being told how they were dying off and how our... We got a sort of...
Was there a sense of confidence that things were looking up?
I suppose I'd have to probably say yes to that. I think the news we were getting that they were bombing Tokyo and they got back on, you know, all these various islands and Borneo and how they'd done them in New Guinea and all the rest of it. Yeah, I suppose it would be that. I couldn't get past the stage of the absolute frustration and the stupidity of it all. We were in this camp in Princess Augusta Bay, a place called Corrikeena, I think it was. How it ever got a name, I don't know. It wasn't as though it was a township or a native village. I mean, the natives, they were called Bungs then. It was a term of endearment, the Bungs, the Fuzzy Wuzzies. They were usually called Bungs. Any villages that you might have seen there would only consist of four or five huts on sticks, and they're pretty primitive people, and the pig was as important to them as anything else. I mean, it was the custom for piglets to be fed by a woman, by a pregnant, you know, woman, a baby one side and a pig the other. You know, that was not uncommon. That's a fact. That's how important they were to them. But we were warned about the wild pigs not to shoot them and eat them because they carried TB, which all goes back to the Jewish part of the Jewish religion, and pork. That was all done for a reason. An obvious reason was that pork was a carrier of, they knew then, even, you know, a million years ago, it carried TB. Mm. At Torokina, was at the mouth of the Torokina River, I think it was, and it was just a bloody swamp. You couldn't dig a hole more than 2 feet into the ground before you had water. Toilets in those cases were just a stick. A trench was dug, and each end of it a Y or a yoke stick was stuck in, and one along the top, and you just rested on that, did your business. And over the top it used to hang a 20 litre, what was it, about a 10 gallon tin. You punch a hole in the bottom of it, stick a nail in it, so, and put dieseline in it, and it used to drip out and burn all the waste in the trough. You can imagine the pleasant smell all the time. It's beautiful. Yeah, oh Christ. There's nowhere else you could, you know, you had to, you couldn't dig a decent hole.
About the weather conditions,
You just got used to it. You hated it in the first place. Things crawled and jumped and squeaked. There's never a quiet moment, especially at night time. Your first night is terrifying. There was an active volcano within sight of you the whole time. I've forgotten its name. It smoked, and you woke up in the morning and you're covered in ash. Literally, you know, lots of it. If the wind was blowing you away, it kept smoking the whole time. This fine grey ash was on you. We lived in tents. We had floorboards, and we actually had stretchers to sleep on. I think we get stretchers by this day, not palliasses, I think. Yeah. Something I learned from the Yanks or something or other. I think there were stretchers. You're all responsible for your own defence. The Japs were just marauding around. It wasn't static warfare as it was in France or anything like that. The Japs, although they got, you know, the obvious the surprise attacks here and there and so on, but the Japs were giving as good as they got. In fact, they gave us a belting up in the north of Bougainville. Some idiot sent them up there in landing ships to go ashore, and they got stuck on the reef. I mean, they didn't even know there's a reef here, you know. This is what gets me. And they send landing. And there the poor buggers just stood there, and they just got mortars and rifle fire, and the Japs are swimming out and chucking bombs at them. Oh, it was terrible. They butchered them all. I think they were there. And they rescued a few out of it eventually. I don't know how many were there, but it was a terrible fiasco. Why they didn't leave them up there, I'm bloated. I know why they had to go and show off. It's what it was, just...
What was the relationship between the men and the troops? The officers and the troops on Bougainville?
I don't know, I only had to do with the guy who was in charge of me, really, who was a Peter Reefert, and he's still here, a mining engineer guy he was. So, yeah, we got on all right. He could be stern with me, and but I came from here, and he came from Nedlands. And I'd seen him quite a bit during my army career, and he treated me as a larrikin, and he wasn't the greatest authoritarian either. I mean, I disliked authority, absolutely disliked it. It was part of my makeup. I think I still do. Now, that may be wrong. I don't know. The war must have been just about, I don't know where, Blamey came up once to Bougainville. I don't know what time it was. And I was one of about, I don't know, 1,000 or 2,000 blokes who booed him. Yep. Top brass, cop this, Blimey, you big fat... all gave it to him. And he just got off the dais and walked away. That's fact. Yeah. You know, in Boy's Own Annual, they'd all be shot. You know? We gave him heaps.
So he'd come to inspect the troops.
I suppose that's what he was there for. I've forgotten. We're all stuck in front of him and gave it to him. Yeah. Well, there was nothing you could do about it. He's lucky someone didn't shoot him, I suppose, actually.
So
You got used to the climate. It rained incessantly. I can remember writing a letter one night to my parents, and I put my army mug, which you can understand was made of enamel, enameled mug, and most of the enamel knocked off it. It should have been made of... The Yanks had stainless steel stuff. We had what they called Dixies, two square tins, one that fitted inside the other, and sort of a long wire handle on them, and you went to get your meal along a table, and they sloshed the stuff in there. The Yanks, when they're in a camp like that, a stainless steel tray. I brought one home. They were beautiful. They had about six dents in them, different shapes, and this little stainless steel tray, and the potatoes went there, and the peas went there, and the meat went there, and, you know. Not us. You put your square tin out, and it went slosh, 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 you know. What went first was finished up in the bottom, what came in last was on the top, you know. And you always got dog biscuits, of course. The dog biscuit was, cereals of some sort, brown, you know, pounded into a hard square lump. They were sort of an almost emergency, not emergency ration, but they were hard tack, you need to soften them. You'd be a weak chewing one. They were hard as hell. They were, get how big they were. They were about 2 inches square, I think. And they were hard as hell, but people used to smash them up and soak them and boil them. And you know, we used to get parcels from home, from the Red Cross. You could write home. Well, I remember the mail hadn't been... We hadn't had any mail for about 6 months at one stage, whatever it was. And I remember, it must have been when the war was over, because it was down at the beach at Tarakina. It was a black sand beach, being a volcanic, and millions of sand flies and a bit hell out of you. You had to get in the water or else cover yourself up. And we never didn't wear bathers or anything like that. And this white apparition walked along the beach, and it was a Mr. Merriweather, who had been my French master at school. I hadn't seen him since 1939 or something or other. And there, 1944, there he is walking along the beach. He said, "Hello, Bowles." I said, "Hello, Mr. Merriweather, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I brought you all mail." I said, "Well, thanks very much, we haven't had any for ages." He was in some part of the Air Force, so it was a peculiar thing that happened.
Was there this strong bonding that happened with people in the army?
You mentioned
a couple of people that you...
Yes, the folks you lived with, yeah. There were six of you in a tent. Absolutely, you knew all about each other and you swapped photographs. So there's my wife or my brother or my sister, my mum, my kids, and all the rest of it. Oh yes, you knew all about it. And when they got letters, everybody talked about what was in it to the other folk. Oh, there was that, yeah. You asked me about the rainfall. I wrote a letter home once and I put the mug outside. By the time I finished the letter, it was about 4 inches deep, the mug. It was full to the top. And it took me an hour to write the letter, so in an hour we had about... The water ran, it was wet. Water ran everywhere. And we're on just a little flat bit of land, and then the jungle started, you know.
What did you do to keep things like morale up?
Well, you're in the army, you had things to do all the time, you know. I don't know that there was anything about morale. That didn't enter into it. You were... Go here, go there, do this, do that, take this, and do, you know, that's what you're told what to do the whole time. There was no, very little spare time. Mind you, you couldn't have lights and things like that. We're talking about a war, and you're up against in the bloody jungle, and there's people out there who want to kill you. It's not quite like a Sunday school picnic. Mm-hmm. But I was it's called a semi-base camp, where I was in an advanced workshop, is what they call it, and it was your job to look after the equipment for the guys that carried the rifle. That was it.
Mm.
Telescopes for sniper rifles, their little 1 meter rangefinders were a great idea, and mortar sights, binoculars. We'd constantly fix binoculars, did binoculars, because the gear get awfully knocked around, you know. I mean, to go from the base camp to wherever this platoon might be, it might be a 10 minute walk, or it might be a half hour in a trailer behind a jeep getting hell knocked out of it. It weren't roads or anything like that, it was only tracks, you know, the mud and...
Did you feel that there was a sense, oh, at least I'm seeing the world?
No, not the slightest. No, I didn't feel like that at all. I just felt I was there, absolutely unnecessarily. People were getting killed for no reason whatsoever. No one will ever change my mind on that. Not then.
What contact, if any, did you have with the Japanese?
The nearest contact was one night. Let's see, they had a picture theatre. The Yanks had been there before us, I think, and built some of this. And there was a picture theatre out in the open. The nearest would have been five rows behind me. They copped a Jap one night watching the pictures. So, you know, I think it might have been one or two of them. They wrestled them down to the ground. That's how close they were and how cheeky they were. Yeah, the pictures.
So they weren't just, you know, these figurative people somewhere in the distance.
Oh, Christ, no. They could be anywhere. They could be just behind there. I mean, the bush, you have to see it to believe how dense it is. It's terribly, terribly dense. Very tropical, heavy tropical rainforest. And the pandanus, sort of a banana tree mostly, but pandanus were everywhere. And they got big leaves, and it's just a solid wall of greenery. And, I don't know, 15 feet or 10 feet in there, there could have been anything. God knows what, you know. They had booby traps of all sorts. We had to defend ourselves. That was where we had them. And the Japs were going around, especially at night, looking for officers. That was one of their smart moves, was to pick off the officers, you know, because once you cut the head off the snake once again, the rest of it's no good. Our job was to also defend ourselves in that regard.
The Japanese,
luckily, we never had any problem.
The Japanese didn't find the jungle a problem, did they? I mean, one of the reasons that they were able to invade Singapore was because people believed that the jungle would protect Singapore from the sort of landward invasion.
Yeah, I heard it said that Japanese said that our men were afraid of the jungle. The Australians were afraid of the jungle, but the Japs saw it as their friend. They could eat this and eat that. I think a lot of that is probably in the first place. We would have been as scared before. We'd think there'd be snakes and twangy wongongs or something going to grab you, you know. But I think the Australian and the Finnish was a match for them, just as good a match for them. I don't know. I think we, as an individual, the Australian could think for himself probably more. I don't know. I don't know what gives me that opinion, but the stories I've read and the mad, silly charging they did and things like that, that they were more... the army tried to make automatons of us. There's no doubt about it. When they march you around for months and months, they're trying to take away your individuality, and they're trying to make something of it. When I say jump, you jump, you know. That's the attitude. I think they succeeded with the Japanese. I don't think they succeeded horribly with Australians. I don't think even in the First World War, I don't think.
Well, there's this the sort of ramshackle sort of Australian soldier, the individual view.
Yes, they were more individualistic. They never were able, I don't think, to take that individualistic part out of the Australian. But I do think the Japanese was... for emperor and country and by God and religion, and they did it.
Why do you think that there was this tendency for the Australians to be, you know, slightly jack of
authority? I've got no
authority.
Idea. Well, I think look at where we came from. Look at the people. Look at all the farmers and all the rest of who were in the army. All individuals who've been through the Depression. All these people. I mean, I was only a 18 or 19 or 20 year old when I was there, but there were plenty of blokes there who had families, and plenty of blokes who were 27, 28, 35, you know, and they'd seen it all and done it all, and they'd only existed because they could think for themselves. I suppose our style of government, and Australian people, well, I think it's changing now, but in those days Australians were very, very much an individual, and he could look after himself in all sorts of regards. There's the joke about the fencing wire and the Australian farmer, isn't it? I mean, it, no matter what it was, you used a piece of fencing wire and it was all right. You know, it's just the makeup where we came from they were pioneering stock and they came from gold miners and things like that, and you just had to be rugged and tough. But and because we're so sparse, it might be the word, and probably a reasonable lack of religion, I think. I don't think too many of them were very religious.
What about the general feeling towards the mother country, as it were?
No, get out, no. No, there's always the joke, if someone went somewhere, they shot through on the padre's bike, you know. That was another expression, you know. He shot through on the padre's bike, you know. Just because the local parson used to ride around on a bike or something, rather very slowly. But these expressions, absolutely no brief for... I can't think what the word is now. But anyway, they weren't very respectful in those regards. And I was one of them.
So what was it like then to hear about the end of the war with Japan?
To me, it came quickly. There was a paper used to circulate called Guinea Gold. It was called the GG, the Good Guts. And it used to tell us all sorts of things. It was a little I suppose it was about, Fool's Cap. In those days, it was Fool's Cap size, probably a couple of sheets. I don't know who printed it. But anything they wanted to tell you, and that they didn't, I suppose you believed it, because it was... But we would get, I suppose, the news of what was going on with the bombing of... When they started to bomb Tokyo and the Japanese islands, and everyone knew that you know, it was either going to be an enormous invasion or something was going to happen, you know. And all of a sudden we heard about this atom bomb. Jesus, what's an atom bomb? Oh, it wiped out Kagoshima. Oh, shit, Jesus Christ. A couple of days later, there's another one, about a day after... I think it was about August the 22nd or 23rd or something. Hey, the war's over. The Nips had chucked it in. Oh, Jesus Christ. Everyone went mad. Went to the officers' quarters and we dragged everything they had out and made a bonfire and put a match to it. Burnt the bloody lot. Absolutely mad. I don't know why. Just to show our disregard. Burnt everything they had.
What did the officers do?
I don't know. We couldn't care about it. They couldn't do anything. Nothing but I know of. What the hell could they? That's 50 years ago. I don't remember anything. What could they do? That unruly mob who booed Blamey out of the joint or whatever it was, whether the war was on or that had happened then or not, I don't know, but no, they couldn't do anything. The war was over.
So what were your feelings towards, you know, hearing the atomic bomb had killed thousands of people in one blow?
When they dropped 10 more, you know, greatest thing in the world. All these bleeding hearts now, so it was terrible. It would have cost millions of lives if it hadn't been for that. And half of the millions would have been ours, you know, Americans and Australians and all the rest of it. No, saved all sorts of things. The greatest thing in the world. And, I mean, I'm no great Jap lover even now. No one will ever convince me that I like them. I don't trust them now. And because everyone thought, oh, the war's over, now we're off home. In a pig's eye. No, you weren't. No, no, for you.